Welcome back to the Thermo Diet Podcast. Today we've got a really fun episode for you all. We were joined by Matt Cooper. How are you doing today, Matt?
Good, brother. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate you.
Yes, sir. Thanks for coming on. So, Matt, you started off as a personal trainer, then you dove deep into nutrition and want to explain to everyone where you are now.
Yeah, so I started just in mainstream health and fitness like any of us. And then, I always joke that me-search turned into research. And then gradually you just keep going down that pipeline and eventually started working with a lot of athletes. And so I guess if you had to put a big broad brushstroke on it now, what I do is integrative health meets sport performance and rehabilitation.
Nice. And you specialize mostly in basketball, correct?
I would say basketball is number one. I also do a lot of football. Back when I was at a different facility that was in the same building as Black House MMA, one of the main MMA agencies. I was seeing a lot of MMA people. I still see a good amount of them. And then I'll see, other sports just kind of all around in general. And I even still help everyday people and people with chronic conditions too, in some cases.
If you had to pick a, stereotypical, obviously there's little athletes that are the best in all sports, the best and worst sport to work with in terms of athletes in general. Obviously, there's going to be exceptions, but is there anything that sticks out? You're like, I hate working with blank people, or makes it hard to work with them. Not necessarily hate, but makes it hard to work with them.
Yeah. I would say just with youth athletes in general right now, maybe every sport, it's they're coming in and I'm like, oh, what'd you eat today? And they're like, or what'd you eat before your game? And they're like, Chick-fil-A. And I'm like, okay, we've got a little bit of work to do here. So I think the idea that to what extent diet plays a role in their performance, a lot of youth athletes are just not fully aware of yet. And I think this is kind of funny too, is back in the day, that might not have been as big of a deal. I'm going to basically do some posts on this soon, but MJ used to have McDonald's every day before a game, or a steak and stuff. Right. And so back then McDonald's had tallow in their fries, not, polyunsaturated fatty acid seed oils, right? They didn't have a lot of these weird extra additives, processing ingredients that they're adding to the meat and things like that. The bread products probably had a lot less glyphosates in them and a lot less just gluten in general. So him eating those things then might have been all right. But now athletes are eating the same things and with all these things in it, it's kind of wild. But anyway, so that's a challenge. MMA can be a challenge too, because you're not only do they have to be healthy and perform at high clip, but they have to weigh this exact number on this exact day, which is can be problematic. And they're just so prone to degeneration via overtraining and under recovering or under adapting their lifestyle, if you will, that one is just, I'm not sure if you can be an MMA athlete and be completely healthy, if I'm just being honest. So
yeah, I think that's a big, and that's something we can definitely dive into in terms of people think athletes are the pinnacle of health, and often they are just trying to stay above water, as I like to say it. Their goal isn't to be as healthy as possible. They're trying to induce as much stress as possible that allows them to perform their sport at the highest level possible.
Yeah, exactly, man. And that's, that's sometimes I feel like that's one of the big athlete superpowers, is the innate ability to override poor epigenetic inputs from the environment, poor physiological, what would be for you and I, just devastating physiological inputs, awful sleep because you're traveling all the time. If you're in the NBA, poor diet habits in a lot of these guys' cases, severe under recovering in a lot of different areas, and then still perform at just such a high clip, And I think that is a superpower a lot of these guys have, but I also think a lot of these guys that you're seeing today just, it catches up to them, maybe not as hard or as soon as it would you and I, but it does catch up to them at some point. Especially you see a lot of guys degenerate as they age, either get injured more often, lose their hair, skin quality gets worse, and you just see it show up so hard. Some cases at that point, it almost looks even worse than you or I in some cases, because when it does catch up to them, it's their environment and their inputs were so bad, it's manifesting a little bit more hardcore. And then, as we've talked about offline before, obviously just, seeding the injury epidemic big time.
Which we will dive into. But before we do that, how did you get introduced to Ray? Ray Pete, because I think you've seen him mention him a couple times directly, but you're definitely well-versed in a lot of his work, it seems like.
Yeah, so I always try to give credit where it's due, whether it's like coaches or him. And there's obviously a lot of like neo-predatory people in that conversation that like are only now just crediting him now that he passed away, which is unfortunate. I always try, if I'm posting something nutritionally inspired from him, to like post his little hashtag there so people like know, since you can't tag him like directly. Yeah. And then on Twitter a lot, I'm posting a ton of his like, you know, quotes and things like that, and then putting it in an athletic context. But I don't know if you've had this guy on the show before, but Dan Dixon, I have to give some credit to him. So I found Ray on my own, and then Dan actually reinforced that. And I think I was actually first giving a presentation in a mental health context to this like, you know, neuropsychiatric group that was looking at alternative therapies like psychedelics and things like that. And I was presenting on that, and I was like citing Ray Pete, and then I was also citing that in an athletic context. And then Dan just, he just kind of helped set that on fire basically. And then, yeah, I think that's kind of the origin story there.
That's dope. Did you find him for yourself in terms of looking through health, or were you looking for more nutrition performance kind of aspect?
Both, dude. Actually, I burnt myself out big time, to the point of feeling like I had a low level fatigue syndrome, just by doing years of like, you know, a lot of sugar avoidance, dairy avoidance, maybe overdoing certain pro-inflammatory, or semi-pro-inflammatory vegetables, fasting, keto combined with like, you know, I only train a few days a week, but I'm like, you know, pretty rigorous about it. And I'm like, you know, usually never miss it. And all those things collectively, I feel like just sort of degenerated my own health a bit. So I looked fit enough on the outside, but was probably like not rotting quite on the inside, but just not super, super healthy. And then, yeah, also wanted to apply it in an athlete context once I saw how well it worked for me after that.
What's your like nutritional history in terms of diets? Like, where do you come from diet wise?
I would say mainstream health and fitness, back in the day where everyone gets into the, all right, I'm going to eat a certain amount of grams of protein and carbs, every 2 to 3 hours, right, for kind of more general fitness goals. In, you know, in that back in the day, it was like you're only eating sort of like, quote unquote, like slower glycogen impacting carbs too, avoiding sugar, things like that. So all the mainstream stuff from there, more of a kind of an ancestral health type slant, which also included not full on keto, but we'll call it like lower carb or cyclical type keto. And then pretty hardcore fasting, I think, before that. In kind of a Martin Berkon lean gains type way. And
I was definitely on that as well.
Yeah. It's really interesting too. Cause like, if you look at Martin, he's also like, I think the overlap between some of these things is actually kind of interesting. Cause he's, you know, he's big on obviously like, you know, protein and like fruits and things like that. So there's some similarities, but also like probably more differences than anything else. But I would say paleo has a decent overlap with Ray Pete.
Yeah, I like to say that they all got aspects correct, but, you know, Ray kind of put the whole picture together. And it's interesting, I didn't know this, but Ray was also a low carber at one point.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I think, you know, I do. I just put out a little kind of like a essay on carnivore eating. And I think I like trying to untangle like why it seems to work for some people and like what are those mechanisms of action and how you can achieve those without carnivore. But I do think if someone was going to do something like that, if you're following it for such a short amount of time, and you're doing, if you are going low carb, the carbs that you were intaking are still, you know, you're still including sugar in that, fruits, raw honey, things like that. Someone could do okay for a really short amount of time and maybe kind of an extreme gut situation. But I think that's more of an on-ramp than it is kind of a lifestyle. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you see a lot of these athletes diving in. Most of them, I assume, come from a mainstream nutrition background. The ones that do hop on these sorts of trends, we don't have to call it a trend, but like the carnivore diet, maybe veganism, you see some athletes going to. Where do you see them tend to go towards? And if so, where do you see if they do tend to fail?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think a lot of them don't necessarily have a nutritional ethos in the beginning. A lot of them tend to do like, quote unquote, classical clean eating, where they're like avoiding things that are containing saturated fat protein wise. If they are following something at all at a young age, so they're, you know, not getting enough beef or enough eggs, usually things like, you know, a lot of things like that, they're kind of like almost averse to, or even dairy. Mm-hmm. And if they are following some type of diet ideology, that tends to take shape for most of them later in college or the professional level. And you'll see a lot of, especially in not a lot, but relatively speaking, a lot of NBA guys and even some NFL guys following plant-based diets. And I know people are going to remember the Game Changers, where I think it was the entire Panthers team, I want to say, or a big chunk of them, plus Cam Newton were following a plant-based diet for a while. And the Game Changers wanted to cite that as an example of, see, these guys perform well. But then you look at that, even I made a post on it, even like a couple of years later, I think it was a year and a half, 2 years, and like literally all those guys are either out of the league or are severely injured. Crazy. Yeah. I mean, it's, I'm also not on team carnivore keto. Like, you know, they all are kind of survival state diets in their own right. But as far as like what's the most degenerative, aside from just purely eating like junk and not thinking about anything at all, I think that plant-based has to be it. If you look at that in the NBA too, you're going to see that the guys who are plant-based almost without fail are either super injury prone or have these kind of like ticky-tack injuries that just kind of like are annoying and show up at the wrong time. Chris Paul being an example of that. Michael Porter Jr. is always dealing with like a super stiff like back and back problems. If you're, that's a big problem too, that some people in the space have pointed out, which is that if you're going plant-based and you're totally avoiding saturated fats, you're getting kind of a, probably a higher degree of inflammation collectively. These things are going to reduce the viscoelasticity, is the nerdy word, of the tissue, or like the hydration of the fascia and the pliability of the tissue and its ability to relax and contract, to store and release elastic energy efficiently, right? And so, among other things, right, I'm sure it's causing electromechanical delay or reducing the rate or the impulse at which like your nerves have an ability to communicate with the muscles as well and time that right. But collectively, you're, you know, all those things make sense why you would have poor tissue quality, aka degeneration, as we in the bioenergetic space would say, if you're following a diet like that. So I would say that's one big one. And then another big one is a lot of guys, especially a few years ago in rehab, like Boogie Cousins or John Wall, were following these lower carb diets for periods of time. And you're seeing those guys tend to lose their burst and explosiveness. I'm sure it's a huge improvement upon the mainstream in some ways, getting, you know, getting more saturated fats in there, more red meats, more eggs. Maybe they're eating more paleo-esque, like LeBron did that one off season between Miami and Cleveland, where he really slimmed down. I think there can be benefits to be had from some of that stuff, but at the same time, you know, that we all know chronic low carbers, usually they're in the endurance community. They kind of all looked physically degenerated. They look like, you know, Yoda or whatever, and they all get super slow, right? So physiologically, you're programming your body to not be able to do exactly what basketball or whatever sport, football, MMA, whatever it needs, which is to kind of have this robust physiology that operates on a hairline trigger, enables you to have a quick burst of explosiveness and then recover to do it again and again and again, right? So they might be able to sort of get through the game on like this 4 to 6 out of 10 kind of level, but they're not really like what I would call highly adapted to their sport in the sense that they can't deliver repeat explosive bursts, right? Yeah. If you look at what nourishes those things, it's carbohydrates, right?
Good old carbs.
Good old carbs.
So what I think is interesting, because in a sense, the keto diets, the low carb diets for the endurance athletes is, in a sense, in my opinion, and I could be completely wrong here, is adapting towards their sport, right? Because they want to burn fat. It's, you know, the marathon runners that typically burn the fat the fastest, I believe there's some kind of correlations with them, their ability to perform well in their sport. But in terms of most athletic sports, not that being a marathon runner is not athletic, but these explosive sorts of sports, it's all about probably the glycolytic processes. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly with that. And this, especially the second point with regards to fast twitch sports being better nourished from carbohydrates, right? Because you need your physiology to operate on a hairline trigger. And some people in the keto community would argue that you might be getting more units of ATP if you tend to stay to the right side of the Krebs cycle a little more. But if you look at the amount of time it takes to produce that, it's like this, right? It seems to be efficient in some ways because you're getting a lot of units of ATP, but it takes a lot longer to do so. Usually it involves cannibalizing your own tissue to do so. As we all know, you know, even the keto guys agree that keto is the backup system, right? As far as that goes, that's literally the mechanism of action that they encourage, is that, hey, it's the backup system. The only difference in opinion is whether it's good for you or not. I tend to say, hey, if your body literally wants carbs so bad, it's going to cannibalize itself and its own tissues via glycogenesis to get there, then that's probably, you know, probably is a pretty good sign that your body needs carbs. That's its preferable fuel, is it would rather do that. But yeah, man, I mean, if you look at the type 2B hairline trigger kind of muscle fibers, like those are fed exclusively with carbohydrates. We still need more research as far as knowing, like, there's not a ton of research in showing like elite athletes and like their percentage of muscle fiber types. Like those are really rare, but a lot of people sort of like Dr. Andy Galpin presume that some of your highest level LeBron or Usain Bolt type athletes have more of those muscle fibers. Then you have your type 2A, quote unquote, or I know they changed it to 2X, the nomenclature, but your first type of fast twitch muscle fibers can be fed both through fat and carbs. But I do think they prefer carbs. And if you look at, like you just said, the glycolysis, it seems inefficient in the sense that you're getting less units of ATP in terms of replenishment, but you're getting it at a much faster clip. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it would seem like biasing the body in that direction would be like just super necessary for fast twitch, or at least to support the adaptations associated with fast twitch sports. And it seems like endurance training, you could get away with it a little more, but mm-hmm. even then, I'm not even sure that higher fat would benefit them as much. I think some of that could just be poor carb quality that they used in the past when doing a lot of those studies.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think probably like being in ketosis for the actual event could be useful. But I mean, I could be also completely wrong there. But so what do you think, what are these main adaptations that are occurring in these fast switch athletes, and how do you think that is affected by their carbohydrate intake or lack thereof?
Yeah, that's a good question. A friend of mine who's also in the space, he's a kind of a strength coach and sort of sports scientist, health researcher up in Canada, Nicholas Simpson. He once broke down for me. You know him?
Yeah, he's a cool dude.
Really, really nice, totally genuine person. He works with a lot of, it's Canada, so winter sports type, ice skating.
He's like a speed skater coach, right?
Yeah, strength and conditioning for that. I think he was with their Olympic team for some of those sports. But anyways, yeah, he and his partner run Vital Strength and Physiology. Really good guy. Anyways, he was telling me one time, he's like, all right, well, a lot of what we're trying to do is basically increase power production for some of these sports, right? And he's like, what's one of the best ways to do that? And then before I even said anything about training, he was like, improve their metabolism, right? Really? So that was like kind of one of those little like, oh shit, you're right. You're trying to basically improve the ability of the body to, I guess, use and then also deliver like high rates of energy over a period of time, whether it's force absorption in sports or creation, right? That all that requires energy and having more energy density in the system, and then kind of like a faster repletion of it, if you will, like being able to pull energy through the system faster. Probably is supportive of all of these things that we need to see, whether it's in the recovery process from training and playing, and or whether it's to support some of these things going on under the hood, right? Like a lot of the neural volley and neuronal communication that has to happen there, like the ability to innervate a muscle, to relax a muscle, things like that. A lot of different rabbit holes to go in there. But one, for example, that's really interesting is all of us in this community report these higher energy states actually being reported coinciding with a higher degree of relaxation, right? And how we feel more at ease and things like that. Well, it's actually the same thing for your performance physiology too. They've actually done studies where they've like put kind of rigor mortis type tissues in big baths full of ATP, and it like causes the tissue to relax, right? And so it actually takes more energy for a muscle in sport to relax than it does to contract. And so I find that interesting when you look at like a lot of the people on, some of these more survival state diets is they can deliver force, but it's more in this like frictional maximum amount of strength over a unlimited period of time, like lifter type force. I think you could probably perform okay in that sense too, if you were doing like low carb or something. But if you're talking about a lot of these sports like the NBA, it's going to require the ability to relax and contract over and over and over really fast over a bunch of periods of time. And I imagine that would just have a giant energetic demand.
I had never considered power in that light versus just a force production aspect, the actual energy metabolism behind the force production?
There's actually, I think I might have the study here, if you don't mind. I meant to bring it up on this podcast, but I'm just realizing I forgot to kind of get the proper name and nomenclature to cite the study. But there's actually some research, I believe it's coming out of Australia, where these guys are actually trying to coin a unit known as metabolic power. It's Ted Polglazi and Matthias Hopp. And anyways, you could look up the study. It's metabolic power, a step in the right direction for team sports. And so they're essentially presupposing, I mean, what I just said, but they're presupposing some things here, but they're basically just talking about the energetic cost requirements for acceleration and deceleration and how we can, they're kind of estimating that at a force level. And then they're presupposing that it's going to take a higher level of ATP or energetic demand to fuel that. But it's really interesting. And even if it's probably hard to isolate one variable for measurement purposes, I really think that they're on the right track in terms of ways to codify and just get the mainstream thinking in the right direction as far as the injury epidemic. Yeah.
How do they have any idea how they would quantify that in terms of like how, you know, me versus you, how would they look at the difference in metabolic power?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of different like individual ways that they would measure that. You know, Ray talked about measuring respiratory quotient as a way to see like kind of how maybe glycolytic someone was. I think they're talking about it here more from like in terms of reading through their work. I think they're talking about it more in like a energetic cost of the session. So they have a unit that they use. Again, it's called metabolic power, but the little, what do you call it that they...
So.
And I forgot the unit. They have an actual unit that they're measuring it with, but I just can't remember that off the top of my head.
No worries.
Probably not something you can use for clinical diagnosis, but it is interesting nonetheless.
For sure. So you kind of want to see potentially in that respect, the highest performers would probably use the most energy throughout the workout, not the least.
Say that one more time.
The highest performers would theoretically use the most energy throughout the workout because they're turning over energy at such a quick rate.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of the thesis of bioenergetic nutrition, of feeding the flame, fanning the flame, if you will, is like, it's actually better to turn your body into something of a gas guzzler than it is like a fuel efficient car. Cause like your body will adapt to less fuel, slow the metabolism down and use less fuel. But in sports and in life, you really want to be a V8, right? You do not want to be like, a weaker car in terms of your ability to perform, regenerate, adapt. Basically that's what all this is about. Right. So I think that's important. And then I think that's also why I believe some people in the space have looked at, I think the test is called organic acids test, but it's like a mitochondrial type test. And they actually look at quote unquote leaky mitochondria or mitochondria that's spitting out some level of byproducts as potentially, depending on what they are, of course, potentially actually a good thing because there's like extra to go around, if you will.
Is that reactive oxygen species or it's like actual mitochondrial breakdown products like proteins?
The latter, I believe. Yeah, I think there are ways to interpret that because I know that you could have leaky mitochondria, quote unquote, and it could be because of like stress causing inefficiencies, like reactive oxygen species. But I believe there's also, again, I could be totally misquoting the test there. I'm not well versed in that. But I believe there's, again, I want to say organic acids test. I'm not exactly sure on that. You can look at some of those like enzymatic byproducts and then look at an abundance there and think that's a good thing.
Yeah. And you mentioned, I love that analogy, by the way. My boss, when I was first getting into this stuff, said, you want to be like a diesel truck, just like emptying out gas onto the road versus the Prius. Yeah. And I think that's a great transition into what do you think, why are we seeing such increased rates of injuries on these athletes? Like, are they all driving Priuses around? Like, what's actually going on under the hood?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, man. Like, you would think with better, as technology has evolved, at least in some ways, or the ability to kind of measure some of these things has, I do think, gone in the right direction in some ways, not entirely on the training side. That's another conversation, but there shouldn't be this big of a discrepancy in the injury rate from how it used to be to how it is now. If you look at a kind of a colleague of mine's like PJF Performance, people know him as, or Paul Favorites, I do agree with him in the sense that the game is played with just such like high impact forces and shiftiness now. Guys are playing lower. Guys are getting at these extreme joint angles you just didn't used to see. There is a case to be made that the body, like that's going to be more wear and tear on the body. Just like if you drive a car more harshly, right, you're going to use up the brakes a little bit more and other parts of the car. So I think higher force demands is not going to, like we probably should have seen injuries go up a little bit by design. But I think the bigger thing seeding the injury epidemic is just the modern maladaptive environment. And I say that because like some people will look at the NFL and there's this big argument now, is it like, is it turf? Is it grass? Is it because they have to play and practice on these two different things? Is that somehow throwing off their sensory systems? And I think that would be a valid point if the injury epidemic was only in that sport, but it's not. It's across every sport. It's absolutely in the NBA. It's in the NFL. It's even in MMA and things like that. Baseball too. And so it's like, all right, it must be a different common denominator. Again, what is this common denominator that all these different, wildly different sports with wildly different force demands kind of have? Like, what is that? And then so I naturally got to thinking on that. And it's like, well, we also see a steady decline in like society's health at the same time, not necessarily in the exact time frame, but you can definitely parallel them for more recent years, right? Let's say the last 20 years. And that's led me to presuppose, again, I'm open to being wrong here, that a lot of this is being caused by the modern maladaptive environment. You know, we're not getting enough natural light and time out in the sun. Kids are growing up like on screens even more than we did in the, you know, television and a kind of video game era, right? And so that's causing issues because people are getting much more blue light. They're also probably using up their dopamine, which is required for muscle firing and wiring as well. You're spending too much time stuck in a state of convergence, which is where your eyes actually focus in, and it's actually associated with fight or flight, probably another stress input there. But also you're losing access to peripheral vision if you're doing a lot of that. So I could see how that would also mess up your sensory systems. Obviously the biggest conversation to have is probably like poor sleep cycles, kind of interwoven with the blue light and natural light point. And that's with everybody in society, but also especially if you're an NBA player and you're traveling multiple times a week, changing time zones in an airplane, just getting, you know, nuked with EMFs and like blue light, you're not getting enough sleep when you land in, and then another thing too, dude, is like the chefs and nutritionists for these teams, like they're still putting seed oils and stuff in a lot of the catering based foods there. So you're seeing guys that are doing that. You know, a lot of guys just don't even think about it. It's like, yeah, it's free. Fuck it, do it. Whereas other people didn't go that route. Like I know Dirk Nowitzki, not to say anything positive or negative about his diet, but I know he would bring in his own food, for example. But yeah, so like a lot of the Frankenfoods, junk foods, it's not just seed oils, as a lot of people in the space like to say, but just a lot of collective bad inputs there from the environment, I think is the best way to put it. A lot of poor epigenetic inputs, more stress, it's going to result in decreased health and performance. So that's kind of my central thesis to how I see things and how I try to address most people in front of me, athletes or not.
So when you say the injury epidemic, what are we looking at here in terms of, do you have any like ballpark estimates? How much worse has it gotten over the last, you know, century or let's say quarter century compared to, you know, 30 years ago? And also in terms of that, are we seeing different types of injuries in terms of, you know, maybe, because I would imagine things like maybe like fractures, like the Kevin Ware story. Maybe I could be wrong on this too, yeah. But like, you know, you have drastic impact things like a car accident. That's really, I would imagine, not going to be too much affected by metabolic rate, but how much worse has this injury epidemic gotten over the last century or so?
Actually, I would say some of the bone break things like Gordon Hayward, Paul George, Kevin Ware could actually be caused in part, not entirely. Again, there's high impact forces maybe being the number one factor, but also, you know, a lot of people in the bioenergetic space that would talk about that potentially being seeded by calcium deficiencies, right? And so a lot of people, even people who are not plant-based, things like that, will be cool eating meat, most people, I think, but maybe like, I would say dairy probably gets demonized even more than meat in some ways, even in these sort of like alternative quote unquote health spheres. So if your calcium to phosphorus ratio is off, that would probably drive down tissue quality, not just in an ability to get calcium in and out of the cell sense for on a muscular level, but also just at, you know, like when you're talking about bone quality too, and bone mineral densities and things like that. So I think that could be seeded by it, but you're right. That's probably not just pure metabolism.
I think that is a great point. Energy maintaining structure. Yeah, I think that is a great point though. I mean, if you don't have the calcium to phosphorus ratio, your bone density is going to suffer. So I mean, you could fully tie that in.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. In terms of types of injury, I feel like you used to hear much more, again, different sports, different, like baseball is always going to have upper body stuff going on, you know, with the shoulder and things like that, elbow, rotational sports in general. I just feel like if you look at MMA, you're seeing a lot more, I think, ACL tears and lower extremity injuries than you used to. Not that didn't happen before at all, but it just seems like that's happened more. And MMA is such an infancy sport, so it's so hard to like, you don't really have data like you do in basketball from like the 90s or 80s. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to compare. I think in basketball, you're seeing a lot more knee injuries. I have stats somewhere, at least for the NFL, where I was looking at like the exact numbers. And even in the last few years, we're seeing, I remember that, like, I forgot if it was this year, kind of the 2022 to 23 season or the one before that I was measuring, but in one of the recent years, it was like not even halfway through the season and they'd already caught up to the same amount of like ACL, MCL, like kind of, you know, serious knee injuries as they had the previous year. And I'm like, okay, that's not good. That's not just like a statistically significant, hey, we're 5% up like in the last, you know, 5 years or something like that, or 10% up, you know, it was insane. I don't know, man. I mean, to me, it's kind of like the most obvious thing, but like, you'd be surprised how like, sometimes it's good at a high level, the training, sometimes it's bad. I mean, I've seen within the same training staff, I've seen guys that are, cause I sometimes have to like communicate with them. I've seen guys that are old school and like kind of more bro science oriented, just sort of like having guys powerlift and stuff and traditional stuff. And then I've seen other guys who are really very smart and forward thinking. But yeah, just because they can afford it doesn't mean always it's, you know, you're getting access to high level stuff, right? Just kind of the same way as a lot of other institutionalized aspects of our society. It's not necessarily a meritocracy. But I don't know why, man. I mean, I, to my knowledge, am the first one to talk about it, at least in a sporting context, as far as the modern maladaptive environment. I haven't heard anyone else talk about it. And to me, it seems like the Occam's razor, shortest distance between two points, pretty simple deductive reasoning sort of a case to make here before looking at really anything else.
It's so strange because you would think they're dumping hundreds of millions of dollars into these athletes. And, you know, you see these crazy performance, you know, everyone has a cold plunge now and they spend, you know, they're just dumping money into it. And then there's this injury epidemic that just seems to be continually increasing. And it just, you know, I remember playing fantasy football for the first time in a couple of years this year. And it's like, dude, it's not even who drafts the best team anymore. It's whose team doesn't get injured, which is almost all on chance. And it's just a crazy aspect of the sport that like, we kind of just accept it. It's one of those things that we're just kind of accepting. It's snuck up on us so much that no one really talks about it.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, if you look at the NBA playoffs right now, like I was just telling my friend, I was like, who is doing good this year? Not in every context, but you know, we're in the West, the conference finals now, and it's like who is healthiest, right? Like some of the most complete teams are underperforming for various reasons. Some of that could be health related, but I mean, I think a lot of these guys are generally exposed to the same stuff, so I don't know that it's that. But you know, it's just who's healthiest. And in a lot of ways, some of these teams are, you know, key guy or key guys get hurt and then they're underperforming, you know? So the champion isn't always who's best. It's just who's healthy at the right time and like good enough. Yeah. Pretty crazy.
I know Hans Selye likes to talk about the whole stress paradigm. If you're familiar with his work, like general adaptation syndrome. And basically it's just some part of your body for whatever reason undergoes more stress. So like, you know, we could both be undergoing the same amount of stress, not recovering, and like you injure your elbow, I injure my knee for whatever reason. Do you think you see that in terms of non-contact versus contact injuries? Like it's kind of just chance whatever someone breaks? Or is there, obviously, you know, like basketball is going to have certain more wear and tear on certain joints than others, but is there like a, are we seeing more of a tendency for certain things to happen, certain injuries to happen from this maladaptive environment, or is everyone just kind of getting hurt more often?
That's a good question. I forgot to circle back on your last point, which is that with cold plunge, like some of this technology is actually maladaptive in some ways. Like I'm not a fan of cold exposure, like at least the way it's programmed normally, cold exposure. Mm-hmm. I mean, just with what that stress input would do to like making your thyroid have to work on overdrives to thermoregulate and heat. So there's really no unifying theory across a lot of this, these different domains. A friend of mine, Pete Bowman of Kaizen Performance, is actually working on, I guess he'd be the first of its kind, but a performance consultancy where you go into these different organizations and help sort of unify a lot of this programming, tell them, hey, I wouldn't worry about this technology. It's kind of just, you know, superfluous, useless. Or just not necessarily super necessary, but I would invest in this, and this. So that I think is super interesting. And then I think with contact injuries, to answer your most recent questions, I think, you know, as much as we do, sometimes shit just does happen. If a guy is like going up to the rim and someone kind of undercuts him and he falls, like those are the kind of injuries I think we had before and are always going to have. Now, I think that your tissue might be more or less resilient because of your metabolism in that regard. And then as far as types of injuries, I don't know, you know, if energy does maintain structure, I think it, like you said, it could manifest differently for you and I. I mean, I know that I don't know if you're familiar with Omega Wave, but it's like a readiness monitoring device. I tend to try to get people away from wearables because either most of them don't, they're not either not the value benefit to cost ratio is just not really there, but I do like how Omega Wave talks a lot about Hans's work and the general idea of stress and something known as sports adaptology. It was actually coined by a guy who, whose work they base their technology off of. And that's Victor, I think, Seluenov. That's how you say his name, old Russian sports scientist. But the idea is, you know, being a little bit more precise with what training implements that we basically throw at folks, but also there's this whole adaptive side of the equation too, which is like, you know, at its core, it is an energy insufficiency, but for you, it could manifest as a quote unquote autoimmune type issue. For someone else, it could manifest as an injury, right? So how it shows up, that probably depends on genetic predispositions and the specificity of the things that we're doing. Like we talked earlier, some guys specifically avoiding calcium, right? And then getting a bone break. So how it manifests probably depends on how we treat our body, the different epigenetic environmental inputs, genetic predispositions, all those things coalescing together. But yeah, at its core, I do think it's all energy insufficiency at some level, contact being an exception.
Do you work with a lot of people that are, or a range of people, or do you work with a lot of people that are have these chronic injuries? Because that's what I would expect people to be like, I can't get my back to heal. It's always in pain. Then I go seek out help versus, you know, the Kevin Wears, it could be a metabolic injury or a metabolic related injury, but they're probably going to think it's a freak accident.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, because I do training, you know, not just nutrition, I do see people for the freak stuff. And then I'm sort of helping reframe it for them when they come through the door. And then I'll, you know, they come in for that. And then I'm asking them like almost like questions like a doctor would on the lifestyle side. I'm like, why are you at, you know? But then I'm like, well, I mean, we're trying to look at origin stories here. And, you know, if a guy, you landed on a guy's foot, okay, you know, you're so young, maybe that wasn't like a degenerative issue. Maybe just a freak thing. But, you know, this is a way where you can kind of make sure that you're bulletproofing your, you know, quote unquote, bulletproofing yourself or making yourself more resilient long term, right? And I'm not saying this at all to like fluff like myself up or anything like that. And I'm sure it's going to happen at some point, you know, knock on wood or whatever. But, you know, in all my years of doing this, I've never had a guy have a severe non-contact injury, like an ACL or a Achilles tear or anything like that. Obviously, there's variables outside of everyone's control, mine included, when you're dealing with other people. So I'm not saying that guys who've had that injury or coaches are bad coaches. I'm just saying like I'd like to think that means that we're kind of onto something, you know?
Yeah, I think I heard you and Paul talking about that in terms of when you see these non-contact, a lot of these non-contact injuries come out, they tend to be really fatigued. They tend to be worn down. It's like almost not surprising. You don't see like people in the peak of their game getting hurt nearly as often as, you know, they have one bad sleep or something like that. It's these cumulative factors that add up.
And then, I mean, that's also one way to look at the idea of being injury prone, right? Like sometimes like could it be a biomechanical, you know, or an issue that's more resolved by training? Absolutely. But could some of that also be, you know, indicators of a problem from a metabolic perspective? I think so, especially when you're seeing some of these guys who it's like, yeah, there's some biomechanical stuff that I'd want to resolve. But then it's like, okay, one year it's your meniscus. Next year it's your like a broken orbital bone or like it's a, you know, like a hand ligament. And it's like, all right, it's a lot of these really unrelated things. And this guy just can't stay healthy. But it's, you know, I'm tempted to look at that and say, all right, this guy's not injury prone in a classic sense where like in a Derrick Rose, like, hey, he just keeps injuring the same, you know, keeps injuring like the knees one way or another. You might want to look at something more performance related versus some of these guys who just keep having these like ticky tack things, whether it's something big and serious or whether it's something like minor. Right. So could be one way to look at the quote unquote injury prone debate.
That is really interesting. Thinking about there might not be chronically the Derrick. Yeah, that's a great example. Like Derrick Rose, where it's a chronic injury of one tissue versus chronically being injured in general, which both probably really suck. But they, one seems like I can't catch a break. The other's just like, I've got a bad knee. But they could both be equally interrelated in that aspect.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, usually these things are multifactorial. In this day and age, everybody's got some, you know, extra stress or degeneration from the environment, probably more so than they did, your average person did 20, 30, 40 years ago. So, you know, I would, the caveat would be that I think that it's probably like interrelated, but yeah, I think, you know, guy keeps injuring the same thing, a little bit more straightforward, probably like lends itself maybe a little bit more towards, probably having more training or movement things to fix, force tolerance things to fix. And my work might skew more with that person towards that side of things. And then other guys, it might be both. Some guys, it might be more like, dude, it doesn't matter what the year is. It's like what part of your body, there's just always something going on. That then that person, that could be an indication of a bigger metabolic problem, you know?
So let's say I tear my left hamstring and I come to you. What is your, you know, general approach for athletes?
Well, I mean, on the training side, there's a lot from like an assessment, that I'd be doing both from movement assessments, maybe some muscle testing, watching film, force plate testing, you know, a lot of different things like that. And then kind of trying to resolve those things through training, both correctives. And then, you know, even on the performance side, loading your body in a way that it's probably makes more sense. And then on the health and nutritional side of things, depending on the person, right? If it's a pro, then I'm just open book. Like I recommend, hey, maybe we could do some labs or some sort of informed testing that could tease out some of this stuff. If you have the money for it and you want to do this, or even just your average kind of well-off person, right? If it's like a student athlete, I'm kind of like trying to like make the most out of what I have, right? So in that case, it's like making sure that they're not doing any of the obvious pro-inflammatory things, whether it's like polyunsaturated fatty acids, like minimizing those. Something I think most people in the Ray Pete community like do a really poor job of is like telling people to avoid at least American wheat and gluten products. You know, it's kind of funny, like they're like avoiding rice or some of these starches like the plague, but they're eating something like the bread products that are just covered in glyphosates and like way more gluten, and like the net effect is way more inflammatory. Obviously, like getting a little gluten in shouldn't ruin your entire weekend, but at the same time, like, yeah, I don't think someone could, you know, with a straight face could say, yeah, like potatoes, sweet potatoes are like, you know, again, of good quality are like going to be worse for you than just your average like bread product, and at least in the States. So anyways, getting people off of like the most inflammatory things, there's other things in there too. A lot of the stabilizers, gums, so on and so forth, at least as much as I can. And then in addition to like having them look at things that we don't include, then making sure they're getting in things like some form of gelatin, collagen, bone broth, things like that. A lot of these guys just don't eat. So just getting them to eat in general, getting them back on like, you know, saturated fats, meats, eggs, dairy, fruits. I actually have like a tub of raw honey at my gym at all times that I let the little like student athletes and inner city kids and stuff just like have pre-workout. So they're at least a little bit nourished. Awesome. I know if they're coming, you know, and I have some electrolytes too. Very simple, basic ones without weird additives. So just trying to like, they don't get anything else throughout the day. At least they have that. But anyways, dude, yeah. So I'm just kind of tackling it from both ends, both the adaptive side of the equation, and then also kind of being surgical with the training and rehab side of the equation too.
I know you've dove into a lot of the PRI work as well, and I've heard you talk about that. And so if I were to summarize PRI in a very probably too short and not enough context kind of way, like we generally, they believe in that there's certain, let's say, ranges of motion, which we should all have access to. And we tend to lose those ranges of motions, and we find, you know, you either compensate up or down. So, you know, you lose range of motion at the elbow, you compensate at the wrist or the shoulder, things like that. And so they have these joint norms, and they use breathing and certain postural techniques to basically bring you back into the normal values. I also do believe, and I'd like to hear your thoughts as well, that the, you know, compensations are your superpower. So you tend to see powerlifters who are not very mobile, but that allows them to produce tons of force. When you are assessing these people, you know, I come in with whatever injury, are you trying to bring them back into those norms? Like, do you subscribe to that philosophy in that aspect?
Yeah, dude, absolutely. I think with PRI, that's absolutely the correct lens through which to see our natural asymmetries, our natural tendencies, the way structure, like the shape of our body and joint angles dictate function. It's not the only thing, right? There are also neurological, if that's hardware, there are also neurological or software glitches. I think that a lot of the PRI, not some of the basic foundational resets like hook, line, bridge, things like that. I think some of those things have value, but also I think a lot of PRI practitioners don't necessarily, like, there's a gap when it comes to the applied side and like, hey, how do I deliver this in, you know, decently fit average everyday people all the way on up to athletes? A lot of times they tend to not, you know, it's all kind of like spinning your wheels. I think for people with super duper chronic pain, some of the basic stuff does so much. But for someone like yourself, who obviously is like active, your average person is like active enough, obviously athletes, they need a higher degree of stress in order to perform. So you don't want to decondition them too. So there are some practitioners who are really good at like, all right, here's how I progress PRI. Some PRI people, though, unfortunately, on the applied side, just like stay in this regressed phase and they don't like, you know, so I just want to throw that caveat out there. But you did a pretty good job of explaining it. The idea is that, you know, down to maybe the genetic helix, I think there's a book called DNA and the Origins of Asymmetry. But at the very least, like in our fetal development, we're asymmetrical. At some level, people already know this because, you know, you have like a heart on one side and, you know, one copy of certain organs on one side. It's not always like lungs or you have both. And so that's because of these internal forces or internal force known as precession. And so if you're looking at a bird's eye view of you and me from the head down and you're looking at our organs, you almost want to picture like a puppet string kind of attached to the back of some of them. Bill Hartman talks a lot about this too, as far as how they're like stitched to the body. And then this internal force is oriented this way or counterclockwise. So what the body does from kind of like a neuro, like sensory perspective, and then eventually structural perspective, is it orients itself in the opposite way, right? That's why you see your PRI would say most people are their trunk is rotated into the right, their right shoulder is depressed. You can't see, but my left rib cage is flared. You know, your hips are shifted over to this side, and your left, the left side of most 9 out of 10 people's pelvis is kind of this way. And that's your starting point. And then they would say for most, like again, most of us, and then layers of compensation, like an injury you have when you're a kid, a sport that you play that like repeats certain motions over and over and over, can then make some of that show up differently, right? So, but that's kind of the starting place for most of it. And then you have these layers of compensation after that. Sometimes the compensation can be good. You might have a lot of physical pain because you're taking your place, you're taking your body away from natural biomechanics, but to perform as a powerlifter, you kind of have to do some things that take your body out of its natural alignment. And so that, again, what might help them perform at a high clip might like totally debilitate you or I or like a different sport. Yeah, the other interesting thing I would say with PRI too is that in a structure dictates function context, you start to see that show up in real time, right? So in basketball or like boxing, right? Most guys are what? Orthodox. So their right shoulders kind of, they're already coiled back in this state. So that's why one of the reasons I think you see more orthodox like boxers, right? Most of us would like throw at that hand, right? It's already cocked back here so you can bring it out. I think it's also why if you're thinking like a rubber band kind of context in basketball, most of us push off our left to go right, right? So it's like if I'm coiled so far to this side, it's like one of those little wind up toys we had when we were kids. It's almost no room to go. Like it's hard for me to kind of like push off this side to go that way, right? So it's easier for me kind of in like a like an elastic stretch shortening cycle context just to globally rotate my body this way and then kind of push off, right? Again, getting into that every contraction is preceded by like kind of a eccentric relaxation, right? So there's that, you know, 9 out of 10 hoopers are going to jump off their left to go right. So you're going to see, you know, better symmetry across the body that way in terms of coordination. But it's also, I mean, the rabbit hole goes deeper than that. Most of us take in the world more so with one of our eyes, right? So sometimes doing different things can unlock different, you know, ocular motor gatekeepers to mobility, other ranges of motion and mobility. And then another really interesting thing too, is you'll start to see, for example, structure dictate function at the highest level, like more and more once you know what to look for. So most baseball pitchers on average are going to be taller, spindly guys, at least relative to you and I. Tennis, same thing, because it's easier. I don't have one here, but it's easier to rotate a cylinder like a pencil than it is to rotate a guy like you and I, or, you know, more like kind of like rectangle shape, right? Or like a bodybuilder type shape. But that being said, guys like myself or like some of the NFL running backs that are more V-shaped, structurally, we're more like oriented towards that. You wouldn't want to see us in a 40-yard dash because we might not be as good at like rotating and some of the shiftiness stuff or things you would need to be good at for like a more rotational driven sport, pure rotational driven sport. But, you know, in a straight line, it's great, you know, and I think even within each strike zone, you can find guys like this. Like Westbrook's going to be more spindly relative to you and I, but relative to his own peers, he's more of a V-shaped guy. And that's why, like, when he gets going to the rim, probably no stopping him, but he's not as like stop on a dime shifty as someone else like a Kyrie Irving, who's again relative to Westbrook more in that silt like spindly kind of shape, right? So it's just cool that you can start to see structure dictate function at all levels, whether it's you and I or whether it's like the pro level.
Yeah, it's a dope lens to view everything from. I think Bill Harmon talks about a little bit, I think I heard him give the example, like for a lineman, an NFL lineman, you want the goal in training them in terms of a PR perspective is so they cannot move or move as little as possible, because that's what they just don't want to be turned. You don't want them to have the mobility to be turned, because that's when they lose. And then you brought up another couple good points, like your compensations or your superpowers, that sort of thing. And Connor Harris likes to give the example, you can't go where you already are. So like these things are like very little, you know, it's not like the average person is going to see, I mean, obviously the lineman versus Russell Westbrook, you're going to see a big difference, but like these small postural changes can make a huge difference. And then they tend to get increased over time, which is where I think you tend to see the, I guess, the more compensations, but also more of the injuries pile up.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, and so my goal is just, you're never going to be fully symmetrical, and that's kind of a fool's errand to chase that. But, you know, what Eric Huddleston of the Pacers likes to say, and he's a PRI guy, is just, if I can give an athlete just enough degrees of freedom where they don't get hurt, then at the very least, like, you know, I'm theoretically making them a little bit more injury prone if they, you know, there's less maybe destructive compensation going on. And then at the same time, like, I might theoretically improve the scouting report if a guy can kind of cross into each hip as good, you know, as good.
So do you find that implementing some nutritional changes in terms of maybe eating more carbs, maybe just eating higher quality foods, allows you to get more structural changes in terms of opening them up to certain angles or mobility, or, you know, the what they would call the table test in PRI?
Yeah, I don't think it necessarily like makes you more symmetrical. I think you have to get that through life and training. But what I do think it will do is improve neuronal communication, like how, you know, the ability to kind of quote unquote activate or have sensory motor competencies and awareness in certain areas. I think it'll absolutely improve tissue quality in terms of, you know, the ability of the tissue to adapt or stretch, contract, things like that, and have the pliability, you know. And then I think also from just a sensory perspective, if it's going to improve your brain and nervous system, then it's going to theoretically improve the ability of the brain to be under less stress, and thus potentially, if you know, the CNS to be more receptive to some of these like bigger changes, you know, that you're trying to program in with it. So yeah, I do think not just PRI, but I do think like training or doing some rehab, corrective exercise without also addressing the adaptive side of the equation is kind of a fool's errand, because there's no guarantee that that person's going to adapt to the stimulus of training. You know,
yeah.
It's like if I told you like, hey dude, like go train like a bodybuilder, but don't like eat for this bodybuilding competition. You know, you place in last. It's the same thing.
Yeah, even if your training is perfect, it's like you need the gas in the tank. What do you think? What I was just gonna ask. Oh, so you mentioned that, and I think this is one of the, let's say issues with PRI, but you mentioned something like the, you know, some of the lower level like breathing drills. You know, it's probably hard to sell your athletes to go do a double sided plank with your low reach sort of thing. And you know, how do you implement these higher level drills potentially? And not that, you know, they're better inherently, but how do you get your athletes or use certain aspects of, let's say, basketball to bring out these qualities?
Some guys are open to doing certain like mobility drills before games as homework, because I think there's an inherent level of, you know, expectedness to have to do stretching, quote unquote, before games or mobilization. A lot of times guys are always getting in there, they're already getting in there like typical lifts with their team in some cases. So I'm trying to tell them like, hey, maybe just tell your coach to not have you do this like a barbell back squat and maybe tell, you know, do this instead. And then, so when I get to see him, it's cool because we can work on more like surgical stuff that they might need. It might still be general, but it's also like at least surgical in like a restorative context. But sometimes it's just like teaching him like, hey, we're going to load you a certain way based on your structural presentations, and giving them just a little bit of buy-in as to why. And then they're like, oh shit, this makes sense. Right. So, you know, maybe having him doing a front foot elevated split squat, you know, lunge hold or loading that position, just to get them maybe a little bit more pelvic access, especially on that left side. Sometimes we might hold it longer, do a little bit more volume on one side than the other, depending on asymmetrical presentations. Yeah. Like, so I'm actually integrating it into the load side of the equation too, not just the corrective side. And that way, I think you're going to see better changes because there's enough requisite stress to actually make a change. For one, and then I think on the other side of things, they have buy-in because they're feeling better, and might take a while to build things like muscle, but they're like that. You get to see some of this stuff show up on the court in no time. Like I have guys come back to me and say, "Dude, I'm playing way lower. I was like I got you know way more steals on defense. I didn't get beat. It was effortless to take off." Some guys are getting inches on their vertical right away. So I think some of the buy-in comes from that. It's like, hey, just trust me for a sec. And then within the first month, sometimes even just sessions, they're seeing big time changes, you know?
So then when are you addressing I would probably put PRI into the category of being more structural. Like, you know, you're trying to physically change the structure, to physically alter their posture slightly, or at least open them up slightly to have access to more degrees of freedom, as you said, versus, you know, I hurt my Achilles, sprained my Achilles. Let's address specifically a tendon. And obviously, you're probably going to do a balance of both. But, you know, the way I kind of think of it, in my opinion, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are. There's really two ways we address injuries at this point in time. You either try and improve tendon quality, so you strengthen the tissue itself or whatever, or not just tendon, but tissue quality. Or you try and reduce the stress that's being put on that tissue. And that's more of like the PRI lens, where it's like, you know, your elbow's hurt. Let's look at your shoulder and see if you have adequate mobility there. Let's look at your wrist and see if you have adequate mobility there. And your elbow is a result of a compensation somewhere else down the line.
Yeah. I mean, those are, you know, I would say in a broad brushstroke sense, those are both good points on your part. I think, you know, tissue quality, so just generally improving people's health, really goes a long way. And then for tendons, surgically making sure they're getting in, you know, what we know based on the body of research we have is like fertilizer for the tendons. That's going to be gelatin, collagen, bone broth, making sure they're getting that in with orange juice. So because I believe it's the vitamin C actually helps it absorb quite a bit better. I do agree with Dr. Keith Barr in that regard, some of his tendon research. So if you wanted to get surgical, some of that kind of stuff, I think is super helpful. I also think like training the foot, strengthening up some of the muscles of the foot, getting it used to elastic loading. And some of these guys over and over and over, reorienting foot position. Do they need more access to the outside edge of their foot? Are they kind of like, are their arches collapsed? Like getting, I think there's an element of rehab where you do still need to get local and go to the area itself or the areas immediately surrounding that and see where this could have come from. And then to your other point, yeah, I mean, sometimes it's just kind of more, you know, thorax and then pelvis integration or core training, quote unquote, and like looking at how the body coordinates and moves itself in space and making sure that, you know, that is good enough, at least to a point to where I know that they're more likely to disperse, you know, maybe activating certain muscles too. They're more likely to disperse energy and force throughout the kinetic chain instead of like over routing it in excess to one joint, right? So we might, depending on the athlete, if they're a super elastic driven athlete, but maybe low on like the frictional side of the equation or like, you know, muscling through, you know, more muscle driven side of the equation, we might do more static holds and strength work and things like that. If they're maybe more on that side of the equation, but maybe they're not as good at storing and releasing elastic energy in the tendons and fascia, we might need to do more of that work. But most of the time, guys, yeah, there's some sort of coordinative issue that needs to be addressed throughout the chain. There's probably some like, you know, both global and isolated activation drills that need to happen. And then again, just depending on the athlete, we're still going to give them both the frictional and elastic side of things. It's just what gas pedal we're going to push a little bit more is probably dependent upon the person in front of you, right? Your average weightlifter who goes out and a person tears an ACL, some of that's probably, or Achilles, they probably are not elastic because they've gone away from that. Probably your average person's really detrained in both. But you know, your average hooper that I'm seeing probably quote unquote disjointed or having a coordinative issue, if you will. And then, you know, probably more biased on the elastic side of the equation for a lot of these guys than the frictional side. So hope that adds some level of context there.
Yeah, that was great. Do you integrate hypertrophy training for a lot of these, like, you know, basketball athletes, or, you know, they don't really need it a lot of times?
Yeah, like, that's a great question. I have no problem if guys on dual curls for the girls, you know what I mean? I don't think there's any harm in that. I also, you know, I'm loading guys, you guys could probably see on my page, I'm loading guys in position and girls in positions where we are still getting some hypertrophy. It's just kind of like in muscle groups and muscle chains, kind of in a more integrated context. It doesn't mean we won't still do something like a hamstring curl machine or something like that. But you can gain mass doing non-traditional stuff too. And then I think just by virtue of improving someone's metabolism and diet, a lot of people I work with, gain weight, but it's like lean body mass, right? And then they, you know, a lot of them are losing body fat too. Or again, they just kind of, their body finally has the nourishment it needs. So then they're, you know, they get a little bit more mass that way. But I actually do think it's important, man. I think that, you know, Lee Egger in the Franz Bosch community talked about how a certain level of protective hypertrophy is really important for contact sports like football, rugby. It was his specific context, MMA, of course, and then even basketball. I also think that through developing fast twitch muscle fibers, and just, you know, muscular development in general, part of like the training, I might not care about his weight per se, but when I'm training for power and training for velocity, I might be, you know, kind of getting some level of hypertrophy in those muscle fibers. Probably not as dramatic as if I was training just for hypertrophy, but I think that there is some level of hypertrophy of fast twitch muscle fibers that's going on there.
For sure. And I mean, it's not like they need it. Their goal isn't to step on a bodybuilding stage. Mm-hmm. So what do you think in terms of, you mentioned this, and I thought that was an interesting point, that a lot of people, and you said people are undertrained in both aspects, but a lot of people, you know, Max Marjo, he talks about this a lot, like people go for the rest of their life after high school and they never play a sport again. They never train any athletic qualities. What do you think are some of the downsides to never training those elastic, viscoelastic properties like your tendons and things like that? just for like the general person. Or also you could ask like for like alignment, things like that too. So you probably don't see them do many plyos.
No, not at all. Yeah. I think for your, I mean, the biggest reason to like kind of make sure you don't go in the wrong direction with any of these physical qualities is just freedom, freedom in movement and do your baseline day-to-day function as you age. I mean, that's just freedom of life that, you know, you have options, right, in that way. And then in this case specifically, yeah, I mean, it's like the, what did they say in the 40-year-old version? If you don't use it, you lose it, right? So it's the same with your body. If I don't care about throwing a 90-mile-an-hour fastball anymore, so I don't really keep up that skill. But, you know, I still will, like, mess around and play and throw stuff on occasion. But, you know, things I do care about, like being able to play a game of pickup basketball or run or sprint and not lose that. So I'm sprinting every single week. You know, I'm faster, actually, than most of faster than a lot of my athletes still, too, which is a little point of pride that I have to.
That's awesome.
You know. Keep intact. But yeah, no, I think when you lose the ability to store and release elastic energy, you lose some of the just generally coordinative aspects that come from playing, whether it's running, you know, throwing, whatever. You just make yourself more injury prone. You open yourself up to more pain. Your body and, you know, your motor development just erodes. You might theoretically prematurely age your brain. So I think there's a lot of different reasons not to. And there's really no reason why. Reasons to keep maintaining your level of fitness, especially on the elastic or athletic side of the equation. And there's really no reason why not to maintain it. You know, what bad is going to come from doing any of those things?
I was thinking about, I was laughing. This guy came over shooting hoops. I'm trying to get back. I've been doing straight hypertrophy training for the longest time. And now, you know, I don't really care that much about it anymore. Like, not that I don't care, I'm going to keep still doing it. But I want to start doing some more plyos, try to build up that vertical jump, stay fast, stay quick, stay fun.
Yeah.
But this old dude came over from the bar and this guy was just practicing his dunks and he was slamming them down. And this guy comes, hey, he's like, oh, hey, I used to build a dunk. You mind if I just borrow your ball? See if I can get it. Dude, this guy got 2 inches off the ground. It was like, dude, did you really think you were going to be able to dunk when you just like couldn't jump anymore? Like,
yeah,
it's crazy. You do lose.
It is crazy, man. Yeah. I mean, and that happened to me too. Like I was just not into sports for whatever reason as a kid. I played a ton of them and I was always like naturally good at them. Like in not all of them, not baseball, but like I was always really fast to where I would surprise people. Not necessarily in a shifty way, but in like a sprint way. And then I was always a starter again with even growing up without like kind of doing a lot of the extra player development stuff guys do now and just sort of not having a personal interest. I was always pretty good without trying too hard at some of this stuff. But then, yeah, I mean, in high school, I actually quit playing sports during high school, got out of it at a pretty young age, and then went all in on like fitness and then detrained some of my natural abilities for some of these things. So the last however long has been dedicated to recapturing some of that to the point that I care about it. I don't necessarily care if I can dunk or not now, but you know, I want to be able to run fast, really, you know, be able to, like I said, play games of pickup when I want and still be effective and not get hurt.
What brought you back in to the athletic sphere?
Actually, just working with the guys. It was like entertaining. It was equally entertaining for them and me. And then there's just something about me, dude. If I don't train like I'm in permanent combine prep for this sport that I'm competition that's never going to happen, I just like I'll go crazy. Not in like a,
I feel you.
I don't deal with my shit kind of way, but in just like, it's fun for me, you know, it's like, I don't know, something about it. It feels purposeful to kind of work your body towards something, you know?
I completely agree. That is cool. Yeah. It's also fun because for me, part of the reason I got into training, you know, obviously I wanted to get fucking big and blah, 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 biceps. But also, yeah, I remember being young and doing like a vertical jump program. And dude, I wish I could go back now knowing what I know and like the ability to train back then. Cause like, I know I could jump higher. I could have like been actually, you know, instead of doing 100 calf raises and then, you know, split squat lunges is like bogus stuff of, I could have actually like made a dent into like what I was training. So it's fun now to see like what is your true potential? Like where can we actually get to? Even if, you know, maybe you're not at your peak age where you could have been, it's fun to see where you can get.
I think it's a lot of fun, man. Yeah. I always think about that too. I'm like, man, as much as I think I'm, you know, nobody special, but I think I'm, you know, I'm all right as a trainer, but it's like, nothing really can like replace just good development from like childhood through age, like early 20s. Like, you know, a 12-week jump program is not gonna make up for that, you know? So it's like, yeah, I mean, now it's kind of funny. I'm like, I do it in reverse. Most people play sports when they're young and then get into some like regular ass job they don't care about, right? And I'm doing the opposite. I was like, I played sports a lot when I was young, but I wasn't as into them. And then now my adult life is like all in on like sport performance and kind of living out. That's awesome. And really interested in some of the things that I like, again, did a ton of, but like didn't enjoy that as much as I did like playing around, goofing off, movies, like time with friends, stuff like that when I was younger.
So I got two theoreticals for you. So let's say you pop out a little coop and his dream is to be, you know, the next LeBron James. What do you, obviously like he's a kid, you're not going to like have him in the lab 24/7 and grinding, but like, what are like the main principles you're going to use to, you know, allow him to excel in his sport of choice, which will obviously depend on the sport, but we can say basketball if you want to get specific.
Yeah. I mean, other than just doing a lot of that basketball, I think making sure he's getting enough rest on his body, not playing one sport too soon, getting like a balanced, like physical and like motor program development. Diet wise, probably a lot of the stuff you guys are familiar with is just making sure he's, you know, eating enough in general calorically so we don't stunt his growth, and then not making sure he's not depriving himself of any or herself of any nutrients. Getting in a ton of, you know, like fruits, certain vegetables, good quality meats, like good quality dairy, good quality, you know, organ meats, and a lot of the sort of more nutrient dense, or as they're known in this community, more pro-metabolic type foods, energy dense foods, probably another way to put it, minimizing the, you know, energy stealing stuff. And then just probably having him grow up with like minimal time in front of screens as possible. Like I don't have cable, for example. Probably not having him get a phone until he's like a certain age, having him outside a ton. Like those would be the main things from like a physiological standpoint, right? Or environmental standpoint. And then I think just probably having him do a lot of these, like, you know, exposing him to like high velocity, like sprinting and jumping and things like that at a young age too, you know?
I also think Paul's approach, I want to circle back to something, but Paul's approach where he's like, yeah, his cousin, some of the kid that he always has around his videos, he's like, I have him playing with real NBA.
Yeah. So Paul's a friend of mine. It's his nephew that he adopted. And then Paul also just had a baby himself too, about a year ago.
Oh, that's awesome. He seems like a really cool dude.
Yeah. Solid guy. Very solid guy. I think that, you know, that's good too. Just play a lot, play against people who are better than you. It's just the same thing in business, right? It's cliche, but people are like, you don't want to, you know, it feeling insecure around the people you're around is probably a good thing, because you're going to don't compare yourself to them in like a paralyzing type way. But like, you know, it should make you want to be better at investing or whatever, right? You know, like it's just like jiu-jitsu. You go in there as a white belt, you're going to get your ass kicked by the blue, purple, brown, black belts. But pretty soon you're going to be getting your ass kicked less and less, you know?
That brings up a good point that I always think about. I never thought about applying it to life, but I don't know if you've ever seen Sandlot, but my old jiu-jitsu coach was the kid that you hate that rides the bike cross, like little blonde kid that like leads the other gang. That was my old black belt in jiu-jitsu, Will Hornif. And he gave me this quote. It's not a quote, but he's like, if you want to get better at offense in jiu-jitsu, you go with someone worse than you. And if you want to get better defense, go with someone better than you. I think that is like a valid point. You could apply to any sport, even across life, just like learn from, you know, it helps to teach people and it helps to get taught too.
Yeah, I think so. Kobe would do that too. He would ask guys who are better than him in one area. Like he asked Gary Payton about defense, and Gary Payton, you know, even like posting up as a guard. He would ask him about that. He was always just willing to be a white belt, even though he kind of had that killer and like fuck you mentality. It was like, I don't mind being the guy who looks dumb asking this question, or who puts his pride to the side, because in the end I'm going to be better than you. Because, and that's kind of like the way I've always thought too, not because I need to be better than, like, I think I'm better than anybody else, but just like, I trust my ability to put all these things together in a way that other trainers can't. And so I don't mind going to this one lecture where I feel like I might know more than someone in some sense, but I really don't know as much as them in this and this and this area. But I feel like I need to get competent enough in that to get work towards my black belt as a practitioner, right? So yeah, I think there is something to that, you know.
That's a great perspective to take. Do you train jiu-jitsu?
I used to for a little bit. I kind of had a little white belt romance with it, but I just never. I think it's good to learn jiu-jitsu. I think if you really love jiu-jitsu, you should keep doing it. If you want to be an MMA fighter, you should keep doing it. I think for your average everyday person, it's probably pretty degenerative on the body compared to striking. And I think that it's really important for jiu-jitsu to know baseline self-defense, baseline throws, baseline, you know, control someone's posture. So in a fight, they can't like posture up and, you know, kind of ground and pound you. I think it's good to know sweeps. I think it's good to know basic defenses, guard. Beyond that, right, I think you can still be a white belt and get all those things down. I don't think it's probably very good in the body unless you just love it and want to keep doing it and want to compete in it. I would push people more towards striking because it's more like decompressive, I think, on the body than a lot of the grappling. But yeah, judo or jiu-jitsu, I think you got to know some amount of that.
So I want to circle back, and we talked a little bit about how, you know, young athletes today tend to be focusing hyper focusing on one sport. How do you think that feeds into the injury epidemic?
Big time. I mean, that's another big factor too. That's like, I guess it's part of your environment because it's an environmental input, but it's not like on the metabolic side. It's probably not training a diverse enough group of motor programs is an issue for some of these kids, and then not getting your body holistic development, right? Like joint repositioning and things like that. Sorry, hiccups. Okay. Might be, less likely. You're probably just getting your body to over-specialize doing one thing, right? Picture a sprinter who's kind of oriented in this like propulsive, positive shin angle way, only doing that and not doing deceleration stuff or playing outside, things like that. I think someone, if they wanted to specialize in one sport, I think, if we still had more recess, or at least on recess, people weren't on their phones, more time spent outside for, you know, like PE programs, stuff like that, you could probably circumvent aspects of specializing in one sport if you were still playing outside a lot. But yeah, I think it's probably a good idea to get people to do more than one sport at a young age. You know, if you're going to do basketball, maybe do tennis, soccer. If you want to do soccer or American football or whatever, maybe also do basketball or whatever. You know, I just think it's good from like a physical development standpoint and like a software motor skill development standpoint.
Yeah, from a PRI perspective, it's probably like locking someone to certain patterns more earlier than would probably be ideal. I do wonder though, on the flip side, is, you know, are all these or some of these super athletes a result of that exact thing, right? They're being locked into these compensations, and assuming they don't get injured, maybe they are, maybe they are becoming the absolute beast because of that, because they've been doing these sports for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something we talk, like Eric Huddleston talks about it. I talk about it. You don't want to take these gifts away from people, because these compensations can actually be why they're so good at their sport. Right. That being said, I think at least in terms of giving them a little bit more ambikineticness, like ambidextrousness for your body, like symmetry. Right. I don't think you're going to take it away from them, but I do think that, you know, giving them more degrees of freedom would help. But yeah, I mean, a lot of times compensations can be like a gift, not a curse, you know, or a gift that needs maybe a little bit of management with it.
All right, Coop, that was great. Thanks for coming on. It was a real pleasure talking to you. I hope to get you on again. Where can everyone find you?
Yeah, appreciate it, man. Really sincerely appreciate the conversation, because I feel like it helps tie together these two worlds. People can find me online on Twitter and Instagram at RewireHP, Rewire Health and Performance. They can find me at RewirePerformance.com. I'm also on TikTok now. That might be a bad decision, but Rewire HP, you can find me there. I have an ebook coming out called Adaptive Nutrition, which is like a guide people can use applying bioenergetics to sport. And then pretty soon the website halflifenutrition.com will be live. And then I'll have I'm launching a kind of a functional medicine grade supplement dispensary and resource, like basically resource page for you know, bioenergetic supplements for athletes, basically.
That's awesome.
And yeah, everyday people too.
Definitely check out Coop's articles. He's got a ton of good ones, especially the carnivore one I really enjoyed and some of his other conversations. And I'll definitely have to check out that ebook. That sounds really dope.
Cool. Thanks, man. Yeah, sincerely appreciate you giving me a platform.
For sure. Awesome, Coop. Well, thanks for tuning in, everyone. See you guys soon.